Air finished the salvo.
Maybe you need to get out more.
The Butte County Sheriff's Department is in Belle Fourche, South Dakota, and is right on the main drag of Route 85. But Tim Berg's house was off that beaten path. A beautiful craftsman facing Hanson Park, the house was made such mostly due to the ministrations of his red-headed wife, Kate. It was all forest green and oiled wood with hanging baskets and multi-layered flower beds that exploded from the rich South Dakota soil like vegetative fireworks. As Vic parked the truck, Henry and I stepped over the painted curb, and I raised a hand to the woman in Bermuda shorts and a Sturgis tank top, who ignored me completely, wheeled a barrow around the corner of the house, and disappeared. I allowed my hand to drop as Vic joined us on the manicured lawn. "Somebody you don't know?" I shrugged and crossed the sidewalk, climbed the stairs, and knocked on the screen door. "Open up, it's the law." From inside, a man's voice answered, "Is the law in here, too?" "Well, then let's have a convention. I've got beer." The sheriff of Butte County was drinking a grain belt northeast at his kitchen table and watching a Duck Dynasty marathon on A&E on a tiny black-and-white television that looked like it got the same kind of reception as the one I used to have in my cabin back home before Katie had ordered DirecTV. "Watching a family reunion, Tim?" He reached out and turned off the reality show. "You know, Walt, even the women on this show have beards. Or maybe it's the reception." He shook hands with Henry and glanced up and saw Vic. He grinned broadly through the hair on his face, looking all the world like a happy hedgehog, and not all that different from Orrin Porter Rockwell, or the guys on TV. "Hey, good-looking." She peeled off his Minnesota Vikings ball cap and smooched his bald spot. "You in here drinking beer and watching must-see TV while your wife does all the work outside?"
"Kind of looks like it, don't it?"
He quaffed the grain belt and resettled his hat. "You guys want a beer?"
"Nah, we're working."
I pulled out a chair and sat, as the bear and Vic did the same. "Anything more on the boy's mother?" He nodded.
"A few things. The folks in that compound up north still say they don't know who she is. But the librarian over here, Pat Engbertson, says what sounds like the same woman came in and was wanting to use the phone books to try and find a number, and that's the one that was scribbled on the bottom of that piece of paper you've got.
It's her mother, who hasn't seen her in 17 years. She lived down in Short Drop in the southern part of Absaroka." Tim nodded.
"Well, Pat says that some young fellas showed up in a Scours-colored Chevy pickup and hustled her out of there, toot sweet."
I studied his beer and regretted my choice not to have one. "Any idea who they were?"
"Well, when I had my little confrontation with the kids up north, they were driving a pickup remarkably of that description."
Henry smiled, crossing his powerful arms across his chest.
"Not showing a lot of reserve, are they?"
Tim took a paper towel from a holder on the table and wiped up the condensation from his beer that was staining the surface of the woven placemat.
"Not their style."
"Anything else?"
"Yep. I was up north, talking to some of the ranchers where they're running that Bakken pipeline."
Vic interrupted. "The what?"
"Bakken shale oil pipeline from North Dakota. They're running it through here, around the Black Hills, and then over your way, and down to the crude oil storage hub in central Oklahoma. Move 200,000 barrels of oil a day. At least they will when they get it finished here in a few years. Anyway, I was talking to Dale Otta, who has a ranch north of here, and he said that he saw that same truck that day up on the ridge that separates his place from theirs. That it was still there when it got done really late that evening, but that it was gone the next morning."
"Where's the ranch?"
"I can show you easier than tell you."
He pushed the beer away.
"But first, I've got somebody I'd like you to meet."
He stood and walked to the back door.
"We can walk, it's not very far."
Henry, Vic, and I looked at each other and then followed Tim outside. Kate, having unloaded her barrow full of compost at the far corner by the fence, turned and wheeled past us. Tim raised a hand.
"I'm going to introduce him to Van Ross."
She stopped, looked at all of us, and trundled on. "This will all end badly." We watched her go and then turned to look at Tim, who stroked his beard.
"She doesn't approve of this particular investigation."
I took a deep breath and shot it from my nose. "My wife and I had a few of those disagreements."
He looked at me, curious.
How'd they end?
Badly.
Through a gate at the back we entered what probably had been an alleyway, but through disuse had evolved into an overgrown path that ran along the back of all the houses facing Hanson Park. As we walked, I asked, "Who's Van Ross?" Tim smiled and continued on.
"Oh, I better let Van speak for himself."
At the end of the block, the street butted into a hillside, and there was a fence like those on the other lots, perhaps not in as good a shape, but higher. From the angle in the alley, you could see that the structure was roughly of the same vintage as the Bergs, but had not weathered the years as well. Some of the windows were broken, and it looked as if they had been patched with sheets of cardboard. Large areas of shingles were missing from the roof, and the rusted gutters hung from the eaves. I watched as Tim knocked on the gate.
"Hey, Van, it's Tim Berg, and I've got some folks who would like to meet you."
There was no sound from inside. Vic ventured an opinion.
"Maybe he's not home."
Tim knocked again.
"He's always home. Hey, Van!"
There was a noise, almost as if someone was banging away from inside an old iron bathtub, and then the sound of someone mumbling, at which point the gate nudged away from us with a metallic sound. It opened inward about 4 inches to reveal a very tanned and wrinkled elf in a faded pair of hibiscus-patterned pink and baby blue-colored Hawaiian shorts.
"Hello, Timothy. How are you?"
The sheriff nodded.
"I'm good, Van, and you?"
"Fine, just fine."
Pulling the hair at his eyebrows, he looked past Tim toward Vic, the Cheyenne Nation, and me.
"Who are your friends?"
"Just some folks who'd like to see your handiwork."
Van Ross glanced at us again, but especially at Henry.
"They're not from the government, are they?"
"No."
He seemed satisfied and opened the door just wide enough to allow us entry. I have seen many strange things in my tenure as the sheriff of Absaroka County, my duty in Vietnam, and even my time spent in California. But nothing could have possibly prepared me for Van Ross's backyard. There was junk piled against the outer perimeter, and poles poked up through the rubble periodically to hold up what looked to be netted camouflage, the kind we used in the military to hide vehicles, aircraft, and other equipment from surveillance planes. All of this was pretty weird, but paled in comparison to what took up most of the backyard. 12 perfectly formed and frighteningly realistic spaceships. They were of different shapes and sizes, but all made of what looked to be aircraft-grade aluminum, and there were hatchways and navigational bubbles that had been salvaged from other planes.
Henry and I looked at each other. Vic mumbled, "Fuck me."
The spaceships looked like they'd been constructed from old science fiction drawings I'd seen on the covers of Popular Mechanics and Astonishing Stories. Some elongated like futuristic cigars, and others assembled into saucers that could have been poster children for the United States Air Force Blue Book. Van beamed in appreciation of our stunned faces, while Tim walked over to the nearest vehicle, which was named the Dan.
"Looks like you're about to finish the last one."
The tiny and what I took to be at least 80-year-old man stepped next to the sheriff and patted the riveted aluminum.
"She's almost finalized."
He smiled, revealing a set of perfect teeth.
"I think she's my best one yet."
The Dan had the look of a mothership and was about 30 feet long, with large, tear-shaped observation windows that were most likely cannibalized from a PBY Catalina. I walked down the length of the thing, ducking under the circumference of a nearby saucer, and looked in the windows, where I could see rows of plastic seats with tubular handles sticking out to the sides.
"The seats are out of Subaru Brats. They had those in the beds of those little trucks."
"I remember."
Still running a hand over his creation, I nodded. He pointed toward the aerodynamic stabilizers at the rear of the ship.
"Of course, when it's finished, I'll stand it up on its end for takeoff."
"Of course." I took the extra moment to get a good look at him and studied his face. He was definitely in his 80s, but the bone structure was fine. There was a small dimple at the end of his nose, and curls of gray hair escaped from under a formless hat that might have been a Stetson gun club at some point. Evidently, he spent a great deal of time out of doors,
working in the reflection of the spaceships because his skin was roasted like a coffee bean. "You did all of these yourself, Mr. Ross?" He nodded, and his voice took on a fervent quality as he again plucked at his eyebrows. "I did. Each one is named for one of the 12 tribes of Israel." Henry joined us, and I glanced at Tim, but he was looking at the toes of his boots and smiling. "How long have you been at it?"
"Since 1957.
The bear nodded his head solemnly.
"Amazing."
I looked carefully up and down the thing, but for the life of me, I couldn't see any air intakes or exhaust ports. "Where are the engines?" He smiled at my naivete.
"It doesn't need them. It will ascend by divine power."
"Ah." He looked around.
"I'm sorry to be so careful. I sometimes liberate parts from Ellsworth Air Force Base on the other side of Rabbit City, and I'm afraid they've taken exception to my combing through their salvage yard over the years."
I fingered a seam. "I bet." He noticed my interest.
"I've used Ace Hardware heavy-duty gutter caulking to stand up to the rigors of interplanetary travel."
I concurred, sage-like. "A wise precaution." He seemed to want more, so I added, "My father used to say that extra dollar a tube is always worth it." He fussed with his eyebrows yet again.
"You see, Adam will return to Earth to take us away within the rapture and convey us to the 12 planets that have been reserved for us."
Wow. I really wasn't sure what else to say. His eyes were drawn back to Henry.
"Yes, and when the great battle arises between the races of black and white, he will return, and those who are true believers will be taken with him."
The bear looked at the elf.
"That would be Adam of Adam and Eve fame?"
"Yes." He patted Henry's arm. "You see, the Lamanites are going to help us overcome the coloreds."
Henry and I looked at each other. "And have we got a timeline on that?" He seemed a little disappointed that I'd asked, and was giving his eyebrow hell.
"It was supposed to be the millennium in 2000. There were a couple of chances before that one, but it was the big one. Then, in 2003, we were not struck by the planet Nibiru."
"Right." I nodded as Vic and Tim joined us.
"December 21st, 2012 didn't work out either, but I haven't lost hope."
Henry nodded in a comforting fashion.
"One should always have faith."
Vic interrupted. "Van, Tim here was telling me about your wonderful talent, the one with dogs." He turned back to me, nodding with a great deal of enthusiasm.
"In my free time, I teach dogs how to talk. I use mental telepathy and can get them to say words like hello, squirrel, and hamburger."
"He's a relatively harmless old eccentric who keeps to himself and writes editorials to the newspaper as the one mighty and strong, the Lion of Judah and the King of Israel. He also calls in on local radio shows a lot."
Vic pursed her lips. "Hell, I tune in for that.
You saw how tanned he is?"
We were walking back to Tim's house on the return route in the alleyway. "Yep, I figured he got it working on the saucers. Did he do all the aluminum work, welding and riveting himself?"
Henry piped up, "And caulking, do not forget the caulking."
Tim nodded his head and stuffed his hands into his jeans pockets.
"He did. He's very popular around the neighborhood. You bring him anything and he can fix it. But did you see his tan?"
Berg stopped and turned sideways to look at us.
"Well, he wasn't always so popular around here. About 20 years ago, the one mighty and strong back there got a revelation from God saying the true believers were going to be taken to the city of Enoch on the North Star. Supposedly, God tells Van that they need to prepare for the journey by protecting themselves from getting burned on re-entry into Earth's atmosphere, so they should get a good all-over suntan."
Vic covered her face with a hand.
"Have you ever noticed it's the people you don't want to see naked who are always taking their clothes off?"
"Uh-huh."
Tim continued walking, and we followed.
"As the story goes, Van was married at the time to two women, Noemi and Big Wanda. And they had some kids. Well, there they all were, up on the roof of the house, with no clothes on. Caused quite a stir."
"I bet."
"They started praying up a storm for God to send them a flying saucer in the middle of the night. And when that didn't happen, Van told them that he might have missed the landing spot and that they should all go over to the city park and wait for the spaceship."
Tim stopped at his gate and undid the latch.
"The old sheriff, Pete Anderson,
Said things must have gotten pretty busy over there, because Big Wanda claimed to have had sex with an extraterrestrial, which Van interpreted as her being resurrected, whereupon he got another revelation that they should pass the resurrecting around by having sex first with one of his wives and then the other. Evidently, it was only when he got divine instructions to have sex with his dog that he started having his doubts. Tim went inside as Vic turned to me and the bear. You know what I said about all the crazy people being in our county?
Yep.
I take it all back. We followed Tim through the gate. I stopped to make sure the latch was secured. To my surprise, Kate was sitting under an umbrella at a round table with five glasses and a pitcher of iced tea. She and Tim were in conference as he pulled out a chair and sat.
Because it's my job.
She shook her head as we joined them. He's just a harmless old man, and I don't see why it is that you had to go down there and get him all wound up.
We didn't wind him up. Besides, he likes showing off his spaceships.
He glanced at Vic.
Especially to pretty girls. You gotta admit it's much better than you want to come up and see my etchings.
Yeah, as lines go. Vic swirled her ice cubes with her tongue. What's a laminite? The Cheyenne Nation poured himself a glass and handed me the pitcher.
Lamanites are American Indians, sworn enemy to the Nephites, both of which, according to the Book of Mormon, are descendants from the persecuted Jews of Jerusalem who migrated to America in 600 B.C.
I smiled and poured myself an iced tea.
So you're Jewish?
Imagine my surprise.
He squeezed a piece of lemon into his tea and continued.
There was a war between the two tribes in 428 A.D., and we, the Lamanites, wiped out the Nephites. Then about 1,400 years later, an angel by the name of Moroni, son of Mormon, a Nephite, reveals himself to Joseph Smith and gives him the golden plates to translate.
Vic leaned into me. You know that part about Catholicism being crazy?
Yep.
I take all that back, too. The bear set his glass on the table with a sense of finality.
And that is how Mormonism began.
Tim looked suspicious.
How come you know so much about Mormons?
I read the Book of Mormon in the truck from Durant to Belfouche.
Berg ran a hand through his beard.
That's a lot of reading.
I am a quick study.
I interrupted the theological conference. The visit with Van Ross was all pretty entertaining, Tim.
But I was just wondering why we went up there.
Well, I got to thinking about that bunch from north of town, especially when I saw that same Scour's yellow truck heading down our street. Hell, Van Ross has been around here since, like he said, in the 50s.
He thought about it.
Except I think there was a stint at a mental hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Kate's voice was a little sharp.
Your point?
Well, I remember when we had to pick him up for the little fiasco in the park and did the paperwork. Hell, everybody around here called him Van or Mr. Ross for so long, I don't think anybody knew his last name.
Her voice grew even sharper.
Which is?
Tim's eyes clicked to mine.
Lanier.
Vic was the first to react.
Oh, crap.
Tim nodded.
Yep.
So he's related to the individuals you had the run-in with and the one we met in Short Drop?
His son is Roy, the one you were telling me about, and Roy's sons are George over in your county and Ronald in mine.
Oh, boy, Vic coughed a laugh. Okay, so we've got Space Cadet Van Ross, the king of all loonies, living down the street, one crazy grandson living on a compound here in Butte County, and the son and another grandson who have taken up residence in our county, with a 15-year-old who's also a grandson somehow tangled up in all of this?
I sipped my iced tea.
Yep.
Henry pulled his dark hair back and captured it in the leather tie he kept in his shirt pocket for just such occasions.
Are all of them as colorful as Mr. Van Ross Lanier?
We all, with the exception of Kate, nodded.
My question then would be, what is the crime we are investigating?
I thought about it. Right now, I'm focusing on the missing mother, Sarah Tisdale. Henry grunted.
And our next step would be?
I turned to look at him and then Tim. You say a rancher with a place adjacent saw members of the compound up there fooling around?
He did.
Was it on his property or theirs?
Unfortunately, theirs.
I leaned back in my chair and listened to it creak in protest. What are the chances of us getting a warrant? In the greater flourishing of time. That's the problem with warrants, isn't it? I turned and looked at both Vic and the Cheyenne Nation. Do you know that we are at the geographic center of the entire United States? She glanced at Tim and Kate and then back to me. You're not having the urge to build spaceships, are you? Belle Fouche, South Dakota, is the geographic center of the United States. Vic continued to look doubtful. I thought that was Kansas. That's contiguous, but since 1959... Tim, who was looking at me a little oddly, too, finished the statement. Yep, when they included Alaska and Hawaii, there's a big visitor center down by the river. But the actual geographic point is farther north, right? He nodded and sighed. About 20 miles, actually. Henry, getting with the plan, joined in. I have always wanted to see that. Tim leaned back and looked at the sun, well past his zenith. We've got the rest of the afternoon to get up there. I glanced at Kate and then back to him. You're not going. He immediately raised his short hairs. All right now, Walt, looky here. We're sightseeing. We got lost. And that's going to be a heck of a lot harder to sell if we're in the company of the county sheriff. I turned back to Vic. Haven't you always wanted to see the geographic center of the United States? She started shaking her head no, then converted it into a nod and buried her face in her hands. No fucking way. Chapter 5. The road to Dale Otto's place was straight up Route 85, and then onto Camp Creek Road. Tim had called ahead, and when we got to Otto's place, the genial rancher had already drawn us a quick map and told us how to get to the outer hay fields, where he had been working when he'd seen his neighbor's truck. He warned us that the road, or what there was of it, was pretty rough leading onto the ridge and that there was only one way up or down. I navigated the furrows and tried to avoid the areas where there might be irrigation lines and a center pivot as we made our way along a rapidly flowing creek bed. Vic kept an eye out for the pickup in question. What the hell are scours? Henry was quicker to answer, even though his nose was still in the Book of Mormon. Calf diarrhea. Oh, gross! We bumped along in four-wheel drive low, so as to do the least amount of damage to the rancher's field. So I'm looking for a truck the color of butt butter?
You got it.
Have I told you how disenchanted I'm becoming with the romantic vision of the American West? I gestured toward the limitless vista outside the windshield. And here you are in the very heart of it. I steered us across a bridge that had been made from an old freight car, a common practice in our part of the world, and pulled up to a number of strands of barbed wire with a steel sign affixed which read, Keep out, private property, followed by trespassers will be prosecuted. I slowed the truck to a stop and looked at the shiners riding shotgun. Feel like doing something unlawful? She cracked the passenger door open and climbed out. Always and always. I was surprised that there was no padlock and watched as she pulled the lever, releasing the pole the fence was attached to, and pulling it wide so that I could drive through as the Cheyenne Nation intoned from the back.
So how did she get the black eyes?
Vic's shiners had turned out to be not as bad as I'd thought, but there were still traces of a rainbow underneath her eyes. The runaway ran over the top of her.
And she did not shoot him?
She was unarmed at the time. The bear grunted.
Lucky kid.
I drove through the opening and then watched as she started to reattach the gate, straining herself on the other side, but then realized her mistake and quickly stepped through, capturing the pole in the loop and leveraging it shut. She climbed back in.
Don't say it.
The trail was rough with more than a few large boulders we had to ease over, but we finally got to the ridge, a desolate spot with only a few copses of Black Hill pines, stunted and bowed from the crippling wind. I pulled the bullet to the right where there was a space between some of the ragged trees and parked. The wind was blowing so hard that it was difficult to open the door, but once I did, I snagged my field glasses from the pocket in the back of my seat. I cranked my hat down tight and stared off through the binoculars to the northwest, the direction from which the gusts seemed to be coming. I could see the fresh-turned earth where the Bakken pipeline Tim had mentioned had been bored along the surface of the land, cutting diagonally from northeast to southwest toward Wyoming. Deceivingly durable, the surface of the high plains held the marks of man almost as long as the land itself marked those same men. Henry drifted toward the center of the ridge, and Vic joined me at the tailgate.
NFW.
It is pretty desolate.
The Cheyenne Nation had walked toward a small wreath of rocks to the west, so I followed a broken path and stopped before entering the bowl of soft earth. From this vantage point, I could see that Henry was staring at one of the towers that Tim had mentioned. It sat at the corner of another county road near the hillside leading to the ridge. There were a few trees in the area that were making believe they were green, and it was painted to blend in. See anybody?
Yes, someone watching us with a pair of binoculars.
Henry, of course, didn't need binoculars, but I couldn't see any movement in the area, aside from a small cloud of dust on the far horizon. I raised my own and adjusted the eyepieces enough to see an individual at one of the windows of the tower before he darted away. Then my eye was drawn to a vehicle racing down the powdery road, but still too far away to make identification. I handed the binoculars to Vic as she joined us. Keep an eye on that and let me know if it's who I think it is. She raised the glasses.
How could they have found out about us so quickly?
The bear pointed toward the tower and then turned and approached the dirt bowl we'd walked past. I followed him and then his gaze. There were boot prints in the area, and tire tracks where you could see they had backed in. His voice was low.
Why back into a place with a pickup unless you were unloading something?
A small line of powder on the lee side of a fist-sized clump of dirt stuck with a few stalks of buffalo grass caught my eye. Vic's voice challenged the wind as she called over her shoulder,
"Are scours a kind of muddy yellow?"
"Yep."
"It's them."
I sighed. How long to get here and up the road we came in on?
At the rate they're going, 10 minutes tops.
Henry's eyes narrowed.
Not enough time to exhume what could be a body, even if we knew where to dig.
I walked over to my undersheriff. "Hey, have you got a lipstick on you?" She lowered the binoculars and looked at me.
"I do, but I don't think it's your shade."
"Give me the top, would you?" She did, and I walked back and kneeled, gently pushed a little of the white powder into the elongated plastic top, and then smelled my finger.
"Quicklime?"
"Yes." I carefully put the makeshift container in my shirt pocket, started toward my truck, and called back to Henry. "Come on, we better not let them catch us at this exact spot." We set about the business of getting off the ridge, unable to hurry because of the boulders. We'd gotten to the last straight, but I was pretty sure we weren't going to make it. We arrived at the gate, and I could see them approaching from the access road on the other side. I figured they'd meet us on the bridge if we gunned it. When I got to the gate, I rolled to a stop and turned to Vic. "Undo the gate, but don't bother with putting it back. Just throw yourself into the bed as I drive through."
"Got it."
She was out like a filly flash. The bear climbed out, too.
"Where are you going?" He grinned the wolf smile. "What, stay in here and miss all the fun?"
Henry shut the door behind him, and I watched as Vic popped the lever on the gate and threw it aside with enough force that I had no trouble driving through. I heard the two of them clambering into the bed as I got to the bridge, but the Chevy roared up the incline and halfway across before I could get that far. He slid to a stop about a foot from my bumper and leaned on the horn. There were four of them, two in the cab and two standing in the bed. The ones there were holding Winchester carbines, while the passenger displayed a revolver and threw me what he considered to be a dangerous smile. The driver was probably the oldest of the bunch, at maybe 18, and he popped the clutch, jumping the two-wheel drive half-ton forward in a threatening manner. Evidently, they weren't intimidated by the stars on my doors or the light bar on top. Advance party. A pack. I heard a clattering on the top of the cab and looked in the rearview mirror and was treated to Victoria Moretti's legs spread in a shooting stance, Henry next to her, leaning against the roof. I turned my eyes back to the Chevy and sat there waiting, looking at them. After a moment, The passenger, who had a mop of black hair falling over his face, leaned out the side and yelled, "Back up!" I shook my head, no. There was a brief conference with the driver, who had the same hairdo as his passenger, only blonde. Must have been the style of the month.
"We can make you."
I didn't move, and the driver leaped the half-ton forward again, now only inches from the front of my truck. He revved the hopped-up engine, the exhaust brapping, no mufflers. The problem with the younger generation is that they confuse horsepower and torque. Most people think horsepower, which can lead to higher top speeds, is the most important. But the thing that gets you there is torque. Neither one of us was likely to reach top speed on the limited length of the bridge, and I was reminded of Mark Twain's adage, "Thunder is impressive, thunder is loud, but it's lightning that gets the job done, even in 1 mile an hour increments." I pulled my transmission selector down and inched forward in granny gear, four-wheel low. He answered by unleashing the clutch on the half-ton and crunching into my rubber-padded, traffic-pushing grill guard. I kept an even pressure on the accelerator, just enough to hold the three-quarter ton in place. He was getting angrier as I held him steady, and he gunned probably 400 horses forward, causing the rear end of the Scours Express to emit blue smoke and kick its heels slightly sideways. Mistake. I waited until he'd reached the farthest point on the pivot and then nudged the broad nose of my